So I've been asked to share with you a few minutes of my impressions and perhaps insights and whatever in connection with my Rabbi Aravan Nachmanstein. Let me start off by saying that what I'm going to say is personal. In other words, it's not biographical and it's not summatory. I'm going to discuss a few things that I know I felt, which may, on one end, may result in the fact that it's irrelevant to anybody else because it's personal and therefore it may not be transferable. And on the other end, maybe Dafka that will be make it possible. So I'm going to discuss a few points, but let me start off with the most personal thing as to why I'm here and how I got into this. I met Rav Aaron Lichtenstein when I was 15 years old, and I entered his shir in Shana Aleph in Yeshivat Yitzchak Elchanan in the old country. And I was, I was an American teenager. Well, not the typical American teenager, but the typical New York Orthodox Jewish American teenager. And I had a good education. I went to yeshiva, yeshiva high school. I never met anybody similar in some of the ways which we'll discuss to Rav Lichtenstein. And that undoubtedly was impressive, and I'm sure I was impressed by that. But, so I would have reacted. At what moment did I realize that this was a different world, that I was in a different kind of experience that my education had prepared me. I remember the day and the incident very, very clearly. I've described this more than once, so perhaps somebody has heard it before. And about a month, I don't remember exactly, about a month into the year, sometime either in Elul or in Tishrei, and at that time, 1965, 2 years before the 67 war, and therefore 2 years more or less also before what at the time was the awakening of Soviet Jewry. When I was a child growing up, we knew there were Jews in the Soviet Union, but they weren't on this planet. I mean, there was like no connection mentally, psychologically. It was like talking about a Seres HaShvatim. And I'm saying that even though my own family, I mean, my grandpa had a sister in Moscow to whom he wrote and didn't get replies. But it was like beyond the Iron Curtain meant beyond the Iron Curtain. That year, Elie Wiesel had traveled to the Soviet Union and had visited all sorts of Jews, and he came back and he wrote a book which was called The Jews of Silence. He made up the phrase. And before the book was published, a chapter of it was excerpted in an American glossy magazine called Life Magazine. If you've heard of it, it's been out of print for 45 years. And one day, Rav Lichtenstein came into shir and said he has something he wants to read to us. I have to give a little bit of hakdama. Was it the first time he was reading it? He must have read it at home before he came in to read it to us. Undoubtedly. Probably read it more than once. He began to read the section. The story, I remember exactly, the story is that it was on Sukkot, and Wiesel visited in some small town. He had been there, and there was one sukkah there that existed. An old Jew had built a sukkah, and a few people had come together sitting at the table, and basically the Jew said to them, we're the last Jews in the world, and after all, old people, and after we die, there won't be any more sukkahs anymore, any more Jews. And he, in his own inimical manner and literary skills, which I don't have, described the incident. But Wilkinson is reading this section. Afterwards, I'd been a month in the shir. The shir was fantastic. The shir, we learned Gittin. There was a hundred times more lundus than I ever heard in my life. He's reading this section, word for word. He's just reading it to us. And in the middle, he is unable to continue. His voice choked up, and he simply couldn't continue talking, and we sat there for another minute, and we got up and we walked out of the room. And that was the point that I'm speaking personally now, that was the point that I became a Talmud of Moreinu Rabbeinu Aaron Lichtenstein. To say that he was a bigger lamb than anybody I ever met was obvious, but I imagine in my mind, then and even now, there were other lamdanim in the world. Maybe even bigger lamdanim. 2 years later, I was in the Rav Shir. It's also a great shir. There were people who were artists or poets or people who were sympathetic, etc. But to me, the idea that this person of such incredible intellect could not only feel, but was in such lack of control of his emotions that on reading it the second or the third, fourth time, still would be overwhelmed by what he was reading. And mind you, I mean, we were young. None of us were overwhelmed by listening to it because we were just cynical American kids. Was something that I couldn't even imagine that a person could combine so many such disparate points of personality together. And I was fortunate enough to be in his shir. That's how I began my apprenticeship by Rav Ari. There is, in theory, there's a machlokas among historians, and I imagine also among Anshei Musa. In history, it's a machlokas between the great man theory of history or the system theory of history. There's a natural tendency for people to pick the great people, you know, Napoleon, Alexander the Great, whatever, write their biographies, because they're the important factors in history. And against that, there's this movement in history that says, you know, one man doesn't make a difference. You have to examine the economics or basic social trends, and one person more or less does not make a difference. Similarly, in Musa, there's also, I wouldn't call it a machlokas, but there are these two different emphases. You can talk about how, you know, this, we naturally tend to think of Gdolim, you know, like one particular person who introduced this idea or this effect on the people with whom he's speaking, with whom he's living. And the other thing would be to talk about or to try to understand the general trends. Where did you grow up? What educational system were you in? You grew up in a democracy, in a modern Western world, or an ancient world, or what school you went to. These things affect your personality and your connection to Kaddish Baruch. And so what I'm going to talk about now, and I'm not sure if Lichasin would agree, is the great man theory of Musa, of Yiddishkeit. That's what I'm going to describe now, is how Rav Lichtenstein affected myself and I think other people who knew him. Completely divorced from the social trends and tendencies and effects of, in my case, to go back to the beginning as I started to now, 45, 50 years ago, and any other time. It might be incorrect, but I'm describing what I understand. Rav Lichtenstein himself would sometimes, he did this in a, he was doing, when he gave a hesped for somebody, he mentioned that in his life, the three people had a tremendous influence on his lives. Three Rabbanim were Hutner, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, and the Rav. He said this in his hesped for Rav Hutner, and he said the following statement. He said this in his hesped for Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. He gave a hesped here in Yeshiva, and he said, when I was young, he was in a Varan Shir when he was 13, he said, when I was younger, I made a mistake, it was my foolishness, but I imagined that someday I could be like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Later on I realized that was ridiculous, he was just, you know, he wasn't in my league. As opposed to the Rav, who I never even imagined that I could be like the Rav. And then he explained why Rav Aaron had that affected him, what he admired Rav Aaron. He wanted to be like Rav Aaron, what he called his foolishness to be able to do that. So when he said that, I lahavd my elef alfay avdalos, because I'm even more foolish, but I remembered how when I was 15, 16 years old, the reason why Rav Aaron has a certain effect on my life was because I imagined in my foolishness that someday I could be like Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Never imagined that I would be like the Rav who I met later. And that's really, I don't know how true that is of other people, but it was so true that I remember my mother complaining about how she thought I was like imitating Rav Aaron, which was probably true. Since then I've stopped imitating Rav Aaron, but maybe some other things have worn off. But why is that true? Like, why? Rav Aaron just said then that, you know, but the Rav was too great. But I think it's more than that. The Rav wasn't a model. It wasn't just that the percentage was too high. It was like a million times greater. He wasn't a model for any of us. He was an individual. He was unique. He was a different kind of a person. But in most ways that we could see, Rav Aaron appeared to be the same kind of person that we were, just a million times better, which then, with a certain amount of work, perhaps you could aspire to be. Ramital sometimes would speak with different people. He would speak about the value of normalcy. In the yeshivish world, normalcy is to be normal is an insult. You're supposed to be special. You're supposed to be unusual. Ramital really liked normalcy. So I don't think he ever used it about Rav Lichtenstein, but Rav Lichtenstein really was normal, but in a very abnormal way. He wasn't normal because he was average. Normalcy didn't mean average. Rav Lichtenstein was extremely not average. It was really unique in many ways. But it wasn't based on taking one idea or one particular midah and racing it to the end and therefore divorcing himself from the rest of us. He started with the same values and interests that most of us had, including things which might be trivial in another sense. I mean, in some sense it's a hesped. Maybe I'm supposed to say this in hesped. But some things about Rav Lichtenstein would in other contexts, meaning not Shvat HaRetzion, might appear a little bit weird. Rav Lichtenstein was known among the Americans in Yeshiva that till 1957, that was the Gvul, you could ask him anything about United States baseball statistics and he knew the answer. One time Rav Tavori, somebody came to visit the Yeshiva in the Beis Medrash, a father with a young child. So Rav Tavori was kidding around with him, so he told the kid was 8 years old, he said, "You see that man over there? Go ask him about who was the MVP in 1942 in the American League." So the kid did it. You know, Lichtenstein didn't have a long beard, he looked like just another one of the guys in the Beis Medrash, you know, not afraid. He asked him, Lichtenstein looked at him and said, "I don't know the answer." Rav Tavori would tell the story much better. He looked at him and said, "You know, of course, Ellie, 1942 in the American League? Ty Cobb? No, no, too late. Hank Greenberg, too early. Whatever." He said, of course he knew that. And it wasn't because when he grew up, that was part of that was one of the things he picked up. And yet, there was a certain factor, which I'm going to try now to describe, which turned all of that into a value. So it wasn't you being normal because being abnormal is bad. It was being normal because normalcy, b'avodat Hashem, is the value of being in this world. And what I want to talk about is this quality of avodas Hashem, being an eved Hashem. The Matseva in Yerushalayim says on it, eved Hashem. That's the only words that appear on the Matseva. So, what does it mean to be an eved Hashem? There's a chug I gave this year. I talked about it at somewhere at length. I'll talk about a slightly different aspect of it. I'll talk about one thing. An eved has commitment. He's committed to, he's not just living to live. An eved Hashem. He has commitment he's in service. He's serving a certain ideal. There was a sikha that Lichtenstein gave in America. He think he gave it every single year. And here he also gave yeshiva, but in a slightly different form. I don't remember the whole sikha, but I remember one line. It was a sikha why we were just young. We were first year in yeshiva then. But it was why you should eventually go into chinuch. That's basically what the sikha was about. And he quoted there a letter written by Rav Aryeh Melech Kaplan. Rav Aryeh Melech Kaplan was at the time, he was a fairly young person, right after World War I, in Eastern Europe, in Litter. Later on, he became the Rosh Yeshiva of Hildesheim in Berlin. He died at a young age, he died in his 30s. But in Litter, after World War I left the Jewish community in Eastern Europe in shambles. So he and one or two other people organized this movement to run around and to build schools. Build schools for girls, I think. Maybe also for boys. He was building schools in different communities. Today we don't look at World War I because we're obsessed with World War II. But after World War I, basically the Jewish communities were also destroyed. Not so much death, but the communities themselves were destroyed. And he writes this letter to his wife. The first half of the letter, which is very, very beautiful, but I can't quote by heart, describes how much he misses not being in yeshiva. It's a beautiful payan to Lundus, how much your soul is enhanced and the beauty and the enjoyment of real yeshiva shalomis, because he was really a litvasher yeshiva bacha. But he's not doing that now. He misses it because now he learns an avodah, but he's running around and very busy in tzachi tzibur. And then he wrote this line, which Rav Lichtenstein quoted, and here's the personal part. I remember it by heart from then, and I don't have a very good memory. Aval kimdumani shetzarich adam liyot tzadik gadol bechasid gamur. Kedei lehakriv al bamat haTorah eta Torah atzma. Person has to be a tzaddik gomer. A person needs to be a tzaddik gomer and a chassid gadol to sacrifice on the altar of Torah the Torah itself. As long as he wanted us to be able to do that. Now, what's the conflict? What's the contrast between eta Torah atzma and bamata Torah, the altar of Torah? There's no question. I mean, we were sitting in shir at the time, and it was a great shir. And we're looking, obviously, it was totally devoted to Talmud Torah lishma in the Veloshin sense, in the Nefesh HaChayim sense. But what Rav Aryeh Elia described in the first half of the letter was religious experience, something which Rishayim wouldn't understand, something which less sensitive people wouldn't understand. But good Jews who love HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who love Torah, do understand. It's a beautiful experience. It's a religious experience. It fills you with it. It's one, enjoyable; two, rich; three, valuable; four, connection to Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's what many, many people search for in Yiddishkeit and religion: a closeness to God, etc., etc. But what the letter said, and Lichtenstein found in that letter, and it was so true of what he was all the time conveying to us, was that's not what you were created for. You weren't created for it to have a wonderful religious experience. You weren't created to become close to God. You were created to serve God. And therefore, paradoxical statements, Amich Adam Liyot Tzadik Gamur V'Chassid Gadol, De'Lakriv Avamat HaTorah Et HaTorah Atzma. Sometimes when you have a certain experience when you're very young, so you know, made a big impression on you, but you're not sure it made a big impression on anybody else. So for me, this sentence apparently is engraved. That's how I remember it. But that doesn't mean that Lichtenstein thought it was a great sentence. It just happened to have quoted it. A couple of years ago, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, we were sitting in Shivad Ramim, and suddenly, I don't remember what the context was, something came up, and so I was sitting opposite him at the table, and I just looked up and I said, you know, Tzvich Adam Liyot Tzadik Gamur, and he smiled, and he finished the sentence. It really was, I mean, just like I know it by heart, you know, he knew my heart, truth is, that's not fair. He knew everything by heart, but no, this you could see, like, I just had to get him started. It was a sentence which really exhibited a central motif. I'm sure you've all heard a lot of things, and you've read, and you heard from people how Lichtenstein was good at A, and good at B, and good at C, and good at D, and it's a very impressive thing, you know, like he was the biggest Lamdan around, and then he was a great, he was a good Jewish philosopher, a great Jewish philosopher, and literature, and a few other things which I'll mention, which I think are all important. So he, if you're best in A, best, you know, somebody, many people are best in A, he's best in A, best in B, C, D, and E, D. Okay, that's all very impressive. But the truth is, the reason why it had an influence on us, I think, influence on me, wasn't because he was the biggest Lamed that I met. He wasn't that. The Rebbe was a bigger Lamed. It wasn't because he was the biggest A, B, or C. It was the unity of it all. And the unity of it all, like I said before in the beginning of the story, the very beginning, I just said, you know, the unity between sensitivity and midos and caring for the Jews behind the Iron Curtain and Talmud Torah, now encompassing all kinds of other things. The unity was Avodas Hashem. If you have a really commitment that you live in order to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so every possible thing that can serve that fits in. And almost everything should fit in, because if it exists, it can possibly help you to serve God. In our world today, where we're living in many senses a dangerous and inimical world, I don't mean physically, I mean spiritually, so many people have the attitude of opposition. You know, the world is dangerous. There's a lot of bad influences. The Western world. Immorality, and kfir, etc., etc., etc. So we have to fight it off. And we strengthen ourselves. We give a good education. I'm not saying talking about, you know, going into the ghetto and building up the walls of the Haredi sense. But even internally, you have to fight against the bad things in the world. A lot of Jews, probably more of us, without thinking too much, accept it. We just accept the world because we want to have the best of all worlds. So we'll daven in the morning and we'll go to our cruise to the Virgin Islands in the afternoon, and we just want to have everything. Bavarin was neither accepting, but not even close to being in opposition. Not that he wasn't opposed to things, but the idea that you define yourself as being how you fight off the world is the stage on which you operate. Our world, we were born in this world. This world, there could be exceptions if he was living in communist Russia, I think he would have gone into a basement and just closed the doors and put on tefillin. But in the normal sense, the world we live in, that's the stage that God gave you. And you have to do is not accept it because it's there, and not destroy it because it's bad, but simply, you just use it all. It's just, it's part of your life. That's what I mean by normalcy. So, some things you have to watch out for, some things you have to reinterpret, some things you have to use, but it's all part of your life. Nothing is there just to be stomped on and fled. And therefore, there's a pasuk that for years I've thought about in the context of Avarin, the end of the pasuk. Now that he's not with us, which was the beginning of the pasuk. It's a pasuk from Eicha, but it resonated in my mind, I think almost from the beginning when I met him. It's a pasuk that talks about there, it's an Eicha, so it's a sad pasuk. Ruach apeinu Mashiach Hashem, nilkad v'shchitotam, when Yoshiyahu was killed in the war with Paro, Yoshiyahu HaMelech. So he's called Ruach apeinu Mashiach Hashem, nilkad v'shchitotam, asher amarnu be'oro nichye bagoyim. I'm not sure what Yirmiyahu HaMelech meant, but he said that he was so upset when Yoshiyahu was killed because he thought Yoshiyahu was the Mashiach. In what sense? He would lead us to live in this complicated world, Ba'orol Nichiyah Bagoyim. And for years, I've thought about that. My connection to Avraham was Ba'orol Nichiyah Bagoyim. Not that he was going to teach me Torah, which he did. Not that he would teach maybe Musa A, B, and C. He would give us an idea how to live in this complicated world. And Basof, in Chinami, in Elkad B'Shchitotam, we no longer have him. I no longer have him to lead us through this complicated world. I'll describe a few things that come to my mind in this context, and I'll try to share them with you. What does it mean, the totality of Avodas Hashem, and how that affects those who grew up with him? I want you an interesting fact. Because of the nature, because of my age, so most of the people I think of who are my contemporaries, like myself, were Talmidim of Aaron 50 years ago. The truth is that most of these people, also because of the job I'm in, are themselves, they're Rabbanim or Machanchim or etc. So it's a little bit unfair. These are people who are actually engaged in Avodas Hashem. They're in the army. They're serving in the army. But we were all Talmidim. I mean, I've been here for 50 years, okay, but that doesn't make a difference. The really important years were the first two. Many of these people weren't. They were learned by Avraham 50 years ago, and then they went to do what they did. And it's the nature of the world. I mean, I had other Rebbeim who were very important to me. They're in my past. You know, I'm very thankful that in this particular year, I learned A, B, and C. All the people I know, and we're talking about important people, themselves G'dolim, are today, when you speak to them, about Rav Lichtenstein, they speak in awe. There's a big difference between youth, who are in awe of their Rebbeim, because the difference is so great, you're totally dependent on them. So you come to yeshiva, your Rebbeim, some of them are like, as the Gemara says, it's very different when you speak to people who are in their 60s, someone who's 80, okay, so he's 20 years older and smarter, but nonetheless, will speak. And the reason is not because he's so much greater than them, but because what they're doing today, the direction in their lives, they got from Avraham. In other words, they view themselves as Talmidim of a Lichtenstein, not because they learned by him once, but because he taught them Oro Nichiyah Bagoyim. And personally now, for myself, that began, the crucial moment was, I remember the day. I was a young basketball playing American kid. And I continued to play basketball afterwards also, with Avraham. But he called me. There was like, after meeting him and having a certain amount of time in Shir, and meeting him and knowing him and hearing from him, he gave a, not by saying what to do, but he gave me a direction where to go in life. To commit myself to something. All those people, and maybe it's the truth that I have to tell the truth. Yeah, maybe that's not the truth. This is really explaining why it was so extraordinary. He wasn't the greatest orator in the world. He didn't adopt special speaking techniques that would be amazingly influential. He was highly intellectual. He didn't give kumzitzes, didn't talk musa very much. To tell you the truth, when I was in the shir, we had shir 5 times a week, 2 hours at a time. You know, where I get my idea that she has to be 2 hours long. So 1 hour in the week, the second hour on Sundays, was a sheer hashkafa. So it's called in Shvat HaRetzion Machshava. It was very highly intellectual. I'm fairly certain that of the 35 boys in the room, 30 were sleeping. I wasn't. I have intellectualism, but it wasn't that he was a great, you know, like a guru. He wasn't a religious figure who could, you know, sweep up the crowds. And that's why it's so extraordinary. Again, maybe it's not fair. Maybe a lot of the Talmidim, you know, who were there didn't appreciate it so much. Those of us who I know, those of us who got a direction, it wasn't from what he said, A, B, or C. It was from the example of his life. So I'm going to mention a few points. These are the A, B's, and C's I mentioned before. There's knowledge, sensitivity, midos, Talmud Torah, Shmiras HaMitzvos. So, I'm going to mention a few things. Talmud Torah. Yeah, he was a big Talmud Chacham. That's true. He also knew Shas Vahat, and he knew all the Rishonim of Shas Vahat. Here's an interesting point, which is very technical in terms of learning, but I think it's indicative. Generally speaking, there are two kinds of Talmud Chachamim in the world. The Gemara says this. The Sina in Okahav. People who know Shas Bahat, and people who, okay, I'm a bit of a biscuit, people who can learn, people who can analyze. If you do it often enough, you get a lot of Bekiyas as well. So Rav Lichtenstein really knew Shas Bahat. And he had, the whole thing was organized. In other words, like all the Rishonim in the right place. He had an annoying habit sometimes, which had to do with the fact that it was normal to him. It wasn't that he thought he was extraordinary in it. If you ask him a question, I remember once asking him a question about something, and he said, the Tosos in Zvachim. So, 20 years ago, I would have just said, it would have gone away and asked somebody else to help me out. By that time, I was already getting a little bit used to him. I was getting over my initial fear of the first 20 years. So I actually said to him, which Tosfos in Zvachim? What daf? You know, it was like the whole Shas was open in front of him. With the Rishonim, with the Tosfos. I asked him a question. I didn't ask a question on that daf. It was a question about something else. But that was where the answer was found. Now, it's famous that as opposed to other people, many other Gdolim, you ask him a kasha, they'll give you the Teretz. Those, their job is to crack a kasha, to solve a problem. So Rav Lichtenstein had this total picture, which he tried to present in Shir, of how, you know, all the different aspects of the sugya, how they all organized. So you can say that was a particular way of learning. It's a very difficult one to convey. Very few Talmidim have picked it up, including myself. I don't do it. But why did he do it? It was the Avodas Hashem. It was like you have to know everything. You know, it's Taras Hashem. So not that he wasn't to answer a difficult kasha, he could do that too. He did it, but that wasn't the job. You know, so somebody would do that, but it was to know it all, and to know it all wasn't because he was very smart and a wanton. Wasn't to memorize daf after daf, but to see it, organize it as a picture, which he then would convey in the shiurim klalim in yeshiva. And why you in yeshiva? So there were bechinas, finals. Every semester there's a final in Gemara. Yishvat HaRetzion, there are no tests. I didn't discuss this with him, but I know that he always toyed with the idea of, he thought there were good things to have for tests. There was at least a few years in yeshiva where he gave voluntary tests to his shir. And the Talmidim voluntarily, some of them took the tests, and then he voluntarily marked them sometimes. But it never took off in yeshiva. But there were mandatory tests. So my first test, again, I was very young. My first final, he marked, and he marked it at, you know, with comments, and it wasn't, you know, what it's supposed to say. He had to analyze, etc., etc., etc. And I also had a report card, and he gave me a mark. The mark was okay. I was a good Talmud. But he also wrote a comment in the report card, which I had no choice. I had to show it to my mother. The comment said, "You're learning very, very well, but you still haven't." I remember the words. "You haven't cracked open the sugya." I had no idea what he was talking about. How do you crack open a sugya? Today I know what he's talking about. He means, okay, so you knew the answer to the questions. Apparently, as far as I know, I got a very good mark on the test. I answered every single question correctly. But he sensed that I was like, I memorized the answers. But I didn't, the mastery, the idea that you're not learning because you have to know the answers. You're learning because you want to be a Baal Torah. You want to be, this is what God gave you. So he thought I hadn't yet. Till now. I hadn't achieved it. Talk about midos. You know, there are big tzaddikim in the world. It's a funny thing. You know, in the last 2 years, people told a lot of stories. People have accumulated stories. Yeshiva sent out letters to all the Talmidim to send in stories. and I read this stuff, and I heard this stuff, and people describe them. None of the stories I heard told, people tell stories about Rav Aaron Behitpalut. You know, how one time this happened to me, and I was there, and he did the following. And they're amazing stories. They're amazing stories. None of those amazing stories amazed me. What do you mean by amazed me? Okay, it's true, I've been around for a long time. I spent 50 years with Rav Aaron. I mean, that's what he did. It was normal. I have to admit, I heard one story, I don't remember the details, so I'm not going to tell you. A year ago, someone told a story that I remember and said, wow, that was like something out of one of the books. Usually when you read about Chafetz Chaim, you read these stories about Greg Dolan, it's like amazingly weird and extraordinary and difficult actions. So, like, what's a typical Rav Aaron story in Midos? This story was told by three different people in the week of Shiva. And I think someone ever saw it. It wasn't amazing. I could have made it up. That's what I'm saying. If I didn't know, if you had asked me what happened when, I would have given the right answer. So someone tells a story. Once upon a time, I hope you can follow me now because it's a little bit beyond your ken. It was before the age of smartphones and email. There was something called payphones. You put in a coin and you could call. Amazingly enough, it was connected by a wire to your parents' house and you were able to call. And Yeshiva had payphones in the Mavoah, which was right next to his office. And basically it was for you to call at night. You could call home. But occasionally someone would call the yeshiva because they had to speak to his child or something like that. So three different people told the following story. What happened is the payphone would ring and whoever was, usually somebody battling, somebody wandering around in the mavoah, went for a drink, would answer the phone and say, what is it? And he would go do it. Avon was in his office, came out, answered the phone. Someone said, is Yanko Pippelflecher there? He would say, 1 second. He would go up into the base medrash, go over to Yanko Pippelflecher and say, your mother's on the phone downstairs. Now, that's not an incredible Musa story, is it? I mean, to me, it is. Of course he would do that. It's so plush to me. Now, it's true, many Golden wouldn't, because it's all the Fichbonim. And the other ones maybe would do it, but they wouldn't do it themselves. They'd ask somebody else, go speak Yanko Pippelflecher, because they realized how do you say this in English, a fadicha. It was such, it's so embarrassing for the Talmud to have the Rosh Yeshiva come tell him that his mother's calling him on the phone. I never thought twice. It was such a double pasha that, you know, calls on the phone. So you go and call the kid and tell him to answer the phone. What amazing is that three different people, at least three people, told this story as being, wow, you know, such a great story. And I'm saying that, yeah, of course it's a great story, but of course it's true. If you'd asked me what would Aaron do when the phone rang, I would have said exactly that's what he's going to do. And something a little bit more extraordinary. Starting in when I was a child, 1970s, gasoline in the United States, petrol for the Brits, cost 30 cents a gallon. Okay, after Mechemet Yom Kippurim, the organized OPEC, the prices reached $1.50, what's it today, $2 a gallon. Prices went up a lot. There was a big, in Israel especially, where there was a difficulty getting oil, but other places as well, so there was an energy crisis. For years, Rav Aaron would be invited to different things, to a wedding or to speak someplace, and he would go by bus. He wasn't 80 at the time, okay? He was in his 40s and his 50s. He would go by bus. Now, it wasn't because he was being cheap. His gas mileage was paid by the yeshiva. It was, and this I have to admit, it would never occur to me to do myself. Never. He said, there's an energy crisis. You know, like, it's ridiculous to have, he had a station wagon, he would take the station wagon and burn. Because those station wagons got 5 kilo to five kilometers to a liter. It's ridiculous to burn that when you can go on a bus to someone's wedding. I should also point out that Bochum and Yeshiva didn't think that they should send them a cab either, because that's the way he did. And that's a different kind of a midah. You know, it's the midah tziburit. He thought, we have an achrayus to the world to take care of the energy crisis, even though I would imagine it wasn't comfortable at all. I don't travel by bus. But he would always travel by bus. Something even more tziburi, which is a famous story that people in Yeshiva know. When certain public things took place in Israel, because he's a public figure as well, the protest against immoral behavior. He and Rabbi Tal will sign the protest against Sabin Shatila, someone even think even more brave and more difficult against, I'm not going to mention names, but Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, who said something about something that took place in the war in Lebanon. In praise of a certain activity that took place, Rosh Yeshiva, who was a colleague in the Gud Yeshivot Hezder, and Rav Aaron thought that it was a chilul Hashem of the first order, and issued a public protest because b'makom sheyesh chilul Hashem ein chokim kavod l'rav. Sensitivity. I'll start from the beginning. In a sikha that Rav Lichtenstein also gave once a year, when I was in Yeshiva University, So he would speak about secular studies, why it's good, why Talmud Chacham has to have a secular education. He had a very specific idea of what secular education meant. As he was often, he often admitted he wasn't interested in mathematics, even though the Rav pressured him a number of times to study mathematics. They said they didn't interest him. He only had a mild curiosity about science. He was talking about humanistic education. The year that I was in the Shir, there was a fire in the yeshiva dormitory in, I believe, Baltimore. Philly? In Philadelphia. There was a fire in the dormitory, and three bachim were killed in yeshiva. Yeshiva in Philadelphia. And so it was a big levaya, and it made a big impression. It was a terrible thing. And he went to the levaya, and he came back, and he described to us how one of the Rosh Yeshiva gave this hesped that he thought was terrible. A terrible hesped means, this is another topic we're not going to talk about, a terrible hesped means getting up and saying, they were all tzaddikim, and it was for the good, and God is now taking care of them. He just thought it was insensitive, the way it was said. He said, if that man had gone to college and read a little Shakespeare, he could never have given such a terrible hesped. It was a standard yeshivish hesped. But he thought it was just this thing that you're speaking to the people's parents and to the people's chaverim and just give this, the sort of platitude, the religious platitudes. It comes about because, and this was in the particular example, is why you should read Shakespeare. But that's not the point. My point is that you think of how something affects all the people around you. This took place in Psak as well. Now my memory is not working, so I can't remember the exact details. I have to take it to me more or less on trust. An example somebody gave me, he went to ask of Aaron, Ashayla, Halacha Lemaisa, his father was older in the hospital. Very difficult situations which people have when their elderly parents are in the hospital, and you don't know whether to do a very aggressive treatment in order to prolong their life, a great pain to them. Questions of medical ethics. So he went to ask Avon a Shaila about a certain thing. I don't remember the details. But the point is, Avon's answer wasn't yes or no. Avon knew the answer. So Halachic Shaila, I want that money, actually, options. But he said to him, don't do it, don't go speak to him today, because he probably, I don't remember the details anymore. Think about your father probably wants to do this tomorrow, so wait another 2 days. The point is, when you give a psak, most people, when they give a psak, serious psak, so they give you the right answer. All of this psak, I have some other questions as well. The psak involved, how does it affect the person I'm speaking to, and totally irrelevant. I had a personal example with me, this wasn't a psak, it was a near psak, but how you pass it. I once had an argument with him. I did a lot of work once on halachic, medical ethics shailas having to do with fertility and infertility. And I had a certain negative opinion about certain engineering techniques, certain forms of artificial treatment for infertility. And so I presented my theory to him. And he listened, and he said, I knew he didn't agree before I presented to him. I presented my theory to him. He said, let's say I would agree with you. The point was, my arguments weren't based on the Gemara someplace. It was based on what we call meta-ethics, meta-halacha, the general attitude of halacha towards this particular kind of physic. He said, let's say I would agree with you, but how could you present that to the couple who are suffering for not having children? Because you're dealing in certain philosophical feelings about what's the proper way, but they have a particular problem. How could you imagine presenting that, whether it's right or wrong? Same thing took place in the hesped he gave for Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. So he mentioned, I don't think it's about Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Shlomo Zalman Orbach has like a million psak under his name. Okay? He mentioned hearing aids on Shabbos. Rav Shlomo Zalman was matir hearing aids. Now I know for a fact that Rav Aaron didn't agree with the heter. Or at least he didn't. If I say he didn't agree, means he didn't understand. He didn't accept that. He wouldn't sign on the heter. The heter isn't that, say there's a heter. But Shlomo Zalman said when he gave the heter was, what's the alternative? The alternative is that this person should live 24 hours in silence. If you can't switch the battery on your, if you can't use your hearing aid on Shabbos, that means that old people or people who need them are going to spend Dafka Shabbos Kodesh in what? In isolation? You have to find the heter. So Rav Aaron didn't necessarily, he did talk to us about the mechanics of the heter. He talked to us about how this attitude, he was, it was a hesped. He talked about the shevach of Shlomo Zalman he was speaking from the lev. I'm giving you a story about the Shavuot Zaman, but it's a story about Rav Aaron. That you know, when you treat a Shaila, everybody knows you treat a Shaila, you're supposed to think of the consequences. It was automatic. You're like, how is this psak going to affect the people that it's involved with? And then that's, you have to be sensitive, super sensitive to that as well. It's a fact. I know this for a fact, that he didn't give the same answer to different people. And those, your answer was always tailored to the person he was speaking to, because part of it was how are you going to understand this particular thing. To give you one final example, which is different, not too much, but same idea. They have now, you can see it on Lom Shavuot on Shabbos. You know, there are people driving around on Lom Shavuot in little electric carts. Based on a heter from the Talmud Institute, how to run these things on Shabbos. Which involves kind of what's called a grum switch. Not a pashut heter. All the people using it are people who need it. For one reason or another. They cannot walk. You don't have to walk on Shabbos, but it means you can't go to shul. It's not pikuach nefesh. You can stay home. But it's a serious problem on Shabbos. So there's this machine that's sold by Mechon Somet in Olam Shvut to allow people to use this. And people are Samechon, Rabbanim are Samechon. Somebody I know needed it. His Rebbe was about the Chassin. He asked him. I'm not privy to the thing. All I know is that it took 2 weeks to get an answer. So you say, am I being critical? Take 2 weeks to get an answer. That's not a good thing. It didn't take him 2 weeks to figure out the lumnus. Okay? That did not take 2 weeks. In the end, I should give the answer. In the end, he told him it was okay. I suspect very strongly that he wasn't convinced it was okay. There was an elevator, a Shabbos elevator in Shivat HaRetzion, that was put in because on the one hand, Shabbat HaRetzion made everything accessible, but it was also put in because Avraham Chassin broke his hip. He never used the Shabbos elevator. It was put in for him. Behet HaShalo. They didn't put it in against his will. He said it was okay. He checked which one they should put in. As far as I know, he never used it. I'm sure he never used it. In the end, he gave the heter because, more or less, I didn't ask him, but what I just said now, could you really tell somebody to stay home? You had to find a proper heter. It was Mamash Asu B'Yosef. But the part of the consideration, the 2 weeks of thinking was whether or not the heter was good enough. The heter, which he knew. He checked out the heter. Grammar is the Gemara. You learn Shabbos. Is a Gemara. Well, maybe you don't learn Grammar. I taught Grammar. There's a Shaila about whether Grammar is Mutan Shabbos. When and under what conditions. Okay, so you know the Sugya. There's nothing. There's no big Kiddush there. He checked out the details. But then the consideration was this particular person. It was also a person who had been Machmir. If you told him no, he wouldn't have done it. That took him 2 weeks to give the answer. And one final area that I want to talk about because it's less spoken of, Lichtenstein was a huge machmir. So we don't talk about that very much because most of us live in an avira, in an atmosphere that says that kulas are good and chumas are bad. So we don't like talking about it. He was a big machmir for himself and for other people as well. When it wasn't the kind of shayla just says now, stam a shayla, but you can do something like a Shabbos. It was a big machmir. I once had a discussion with him, which I never get to the final answer. About one of the guys, somebody in the kollel asked of Lichtenstein, whether you can give a child, you can wind up the spring on a little car, you know, the car with a key and a spring. Whether it's mutar on Shabbos, it's metakein mana. Car doesn't work until you fix it, until you do the spring. But that's what's called metakein mana. So the man thought it was asa. He told him it was asa. So I just seen that sugya, right? So I said to him, well, if that's asa, then how can you open the door of the Beis Medrash? Because when you open the door of the Beis Medrash, you're compressing a spring, which then closes the door. It's exactly the same. So you couldn't get out of the Beis Medrash. Now, the truth is, this took place in the middle of davening on Shabbos. So he said, I have to think about that. I never bothered to get the rest of the answer. But I'm just saying, this is something which it says, Shul Shabbos Chasuz Mutter. He said it was asa. Why do you say it's asa? The truth is, if there were 2 days, Rav Aaron would be machmir. This is Machlok Zishon. He's going to be machmir. That was part of his Avodas Hashem in a very simple manner. I know that we've heard a lot of propaganda against Chumas. Rav Aaron thought that if you have a suffix, you should be machmir because we're doing God's will. You don't take a chance on things like that. He knew how to be machmir when it was important. But Chumas was part of Avodas Hashem. You have to know exactly how to eat matzah. You have to know how to blow shofar. You might have noticed that Yeshivat HaRetzion blows 102 kolos in Rosh Hashanah, which is now what it says. It's not a big Chumas, but there's another 2 kolos there and it's based on. There are 4 shitas. You have to be also 4 shitas. Why? How can you be mivata on shitas? So you combine a few and you get 102 calls instead of 100. And if we cook a few more kolos, it'll be more kolos. And it was pretty machmir kis as well. It can be made from my own experience. It wasn't easy to get a tkiya, at least not in the good years. It wasn't easy to get a bad tkiya. Bad tkiya past them. Because one time they found a mistake in the Sefer Torah. Halacha psuka. You found a mistake, you read the same, you go back to the Aliyah in which you read and you read it again. That's the final psak in all the Achronim. So Rav Arad got up on the spot and said, well, you know, that's true in Balabatim because of the problem of Tircha de Tzibura. But there's the yeshiva. No one here is going anywhere. You guys are all sitting here waiting for lunch. The Ram thinks okay, but according to the other sheet, I don't remember which sheet, the Rashba, we read the whole Pashal. It wasn't for, you say, he's machmir for himself. No, he was machmir for us. He was machmir for 500 people. He was a big machmir. If there's a suffix in two possibilities, so you should go lechumah. You should go lechumah. And if you left it, you would do chumah. Is that a terrible thing? There's a unified vision that I exist to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And those of us who were privileged to see it and to learn it, I think that's what affected us. That's what made us into Talmidim. Not this shita or that shita. There was also they also taught us how to learn, taught me how to read a Rambam. But that he gave us Eich lichyot ba'olam, Eich lichyot ba'goyim. How to take the world as it is and utilize it and subjugate it to the will of God and make ourselves to be subject to the will of God. And to do it in a manner that's not crazy or fanatic or revolutionary, but using everything, all the things that you can learn. So your education is part of that and understanding the world is part of that and reading to have to understand the world. So your sensitivity to the world, understanding people, understanding halacha, everything is part of how we can make the world a better place, how we can make the world something which serves HaKadosh Baruch. I want to add one thing at the end. I was wondering about this, the purpose of this meeting. Because, generally speaking, I mean, this is a kind of a hesped. Hespedim are given after people die. Why? What's the point in my trying to describe why I think Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was very important to me? And maybe why he should have been important to you had you been here. But you weren't. And you're showing that now. So what are you supposed to learn from this? So some classical Hespedim might be to tell you, well, you should be the same one. In other words, I tell stories about Gedolim. It's to inspire the congregation to do the same thing. That's why if the stories are too great, so nobody really learns from them. But that's not what I tried to do. I tried to explain what were the qualities of this person that made it important for me, but I was there, so that's why it was important to me. But what are you supposed to get from this? It's too late for you to now pay more attention. The truth was, in the years when Rav Aaron was alive, so sometimes I would try to get Talmidim to pay attention, to see, because he's such an ordinary person in so many ways, you could miss it. People didn't realize, because he was facing the wrong direction, how Rav Aaron would be crying during Shir HaShirim on Yom Yerushalayim. For years, I had this tremendous, I didn't see it either, I just knew it was taking place. I wanted to see what his face looks like when you say, Shubi, Shubi, Ashunam, the Shubi, Shubi, Venechazabach. Because I could see that he was getting also. How do you do that? He's facing the wrong direction. I was embarrassed to get up and do what you have to do, which is to walk in front and put your face in front of him and see. So finally, the time was running out. One time I went all the way on the other side, from the Amital side, and I tried to get, by looking behind the Aaron Kodesh, it didn't work. I never got to see his face. But occasionally I would say, you know, I try to get the guys to appreciate it because I sometimes thought that people weren't appreciating it enough. Because it was such a, you know, a regular guy, no beard, you know, no baseball scores. They could miss it. But anyhow, but now it's too late. So, I'll tell you what I think. And it's a complicated thing. What was my point here? My point was not that you should now learn from Avraham, because it's too late. But by trying to describe the normalcy, is perhaps you should be now more sensitive to do it from others as well. Avraham's Talmidim or any other people, that this derech of taking the world that we're living in, and using it to be totally committed. The extreme here is not the extremism. Totally committed to being normal. Totally committed to taking everything by Bodhis Hashem. That's something which, if you didn't see the original, so maybe maybe if you know how to look for it and understand it, you'll see it in the models, in the reproductions. You know, if you go to buy a Rembrandt, so it costs 12 million bucks. And on the internet, you can order a copy of a Rembrandt for $500. So there are some people who would say, it's not the same thing. They're probably right. But between you and me, if we bought the reproduction, it'd be just as good. After I convinced my wife to shell out $500, I plan to buy one Rembrandt that way. She said, what do you do when people walk into the house and they're going to say, what, you stole a Rembrandt? I say, yeah, okay, you know. It's just as good, almost, even though there's a tremendous difference. So my goal here is, if it's possible, is to get you to learn to look at the reproductions, the vague reproductions, the deficient reproductions, because they're not on the same level. And perhaps also learn from there, not a chiddush here or a chiddush there, but to learn what I tried to learn, or what I did learn to a certain extent, maybe didn't carry out enough, is eich lichyot bagoyim, to get the mission of that we're here to l'taker olam malchut shakai, to use the world to make the world a better place to be a bodas Hashem. I mentioned this. This is the line that I use. This line I spoke to Hesper 2 years ago at the Levaya. So I'm just going to repeat it now because I think it's meaningful. When Elisha leaves Eliyahu, Eliyahu goes up the Sarah HaShamayma, and his Adevet Eliyahu falls. Eliyahu picks it up. He's on the other side of the Yarden. And he goes back to the Yarden. They cross the Yarden because Eliyahu split the Yarden to allow them to cross. Now they go back and there's water there. And Eliyahu has to cross the Yarden. He's holding Adevet Eliyahu, but he does not, but the water is still there. So Elisha says, Ayei Hashem Elokei Eliyahu, and then he hits the water and it splits. And then the Talmidim on the other side, the Bnei Nevi'im on the other side, know that he is the worthy successor of Eliyahu. That expression is something which should give any of us, the education that we've had, should give us the shudders. Elisha is praying to God, and he says, Ayei Hashem Elokei Eliyahu. I mean, Eliyahu was a great man, but, I mean, Hashem Elokei Yisrael, or Elokei Vam Yisrael Kei Yaakov. None of us have ever prayed to Elokei, somebody we knew. In the Tanakh, you know, Yitzhak Avinu can say, or Yaakov Avinu can say, Pachad Yitzhak Aviv. Say that was where it all began. But in our experience, I think we're careful. We don't want to do something like that. Shmuel is bigger than. Why did Elisha say, it's the only time he says it, this, Ayei Hashem Elokei Eliyahu. It indicates the importance, what I began by saying, the great man history, the theory of history, the importance of the personal contact. B'sofo shel davar, there's nothing I learned from Rav Lichtenstein that I couldn't have learned someplace else. Give or take. Chiddush here, chiddush there. But it's all in the Sfarim somewhere. Or there'll be someone else who'll figure it out at some other time. But the truth is that Torah is taught ish mi pi ish, and your connection to Torah and your connection to Kadosh Baruch Hu comes from the people who instilled it in you. And Elisha had a problem. He had to cross the river, and the river wasn't crossable. He was at a crisis. And at that point, he said, "What my ability to cross this river, in that case, talking about Nisim of Eliyahu and Elisha, so it's really true, comes from what I got this from Eliyahu. I didn't get from any place else." And in that sense, he said, he didn't ask Eliyahu to help him. He said, Ayei Hashem Elokei Eliyahu Vayach Ba'aderes Al Amayim Vayifku Amayim. And that allowed him, that's how you split. When you come to an obstacle, when you come to the end of the road, you can split that rock and go forward. If you have something, a direct connection to the person who taught you how to move forward, taught you how to walk. Elisha was taught how to walk by Eliyahu. And when it didn't work on his own koach, so he appealed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But who was his God? His God wasn't this something we learn from books, something you learn from theology, you know, something that's vague, or it was personal. It was the God he'd been taught to by his Rebbe. Ayei Hashem Elokei Eliyahu. For those of us who were zocha to be direct talmidim of Maran HaRav Aaron, so sometimes that's what happens. You take a step forward because it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who you got, the God you got from him. Each person has to have, you can't just hang out in yeshiva and learn Torah. There's a direct connection to somebody, to something. And that example, what I again repeat, something which I think you can achieve in yeshiva, and the model for us, for the people who are now, was Moreinu, and in that sense it can continue. Thank you.